I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. What would you do if everything you loved was at risk of being destroyed? How would you react if the future of those you cared about most was in jeopardy? This is the dilemma facing Pasha Talankin in the 2026 Oscar award-winning documentary, Mr. Nobody Against Putin. Pasha's a beloved teacher, dedicated to his students, with deep emotional ties to the small industrial town of Karabash, where he spent his entire life. But when the war starts, he finds himself a cog in Putin's machinery to produce more soldiers for the endless slaughter in Ukraine. As a school events coordinator, his greatest joy was to find ways for students to express themselves, to become themselves. Now he's forced to witness the daily anthem singing, scripted history lessons, and military drills, a program of indoctrination that crowds out learning and crushes individual growth and development. Even worse, as a school videographer, he's required to record everything and to submit his recordings to a government site as proof of compliance with the new state patriotic education directives. But everything changes when a chance encounter connects Pasha with American documentary director David Borenstein. Pasha accepts Borenstein's offer to use his camera to document all that's happening in the school. In what becomes the ultimate act of love and sacrifice, Pasha risks everything to show the world the untold harm Putin is inflicting on future generations of Russians and the world. In a special return to the podcast, Katya Haskins will be sharing her thoughts on Mr. Nobody Against Putin. Katya is a professor of rhetoric and visual studies at Pennsylvania State University and the author of Remembering the War, Forgetting the Terror, Appeals to Family Memory in Putin's Russia, now available in paperback. She's also a graduate of Moscow State University who experienced firsthand the end of the Soviet Union. A conversation with Katya Haskins about Mr. Nobody Against Putin in this episode of Realms of Memory. Katya, welcome back to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me back, Rick.
So I watched this documentary recently, kind of by chance. I mean, I had watched the Oscars, so I had seen it get a prize. But, you know, documentaries, they don't spend a whole lot of time on TV featuring those awards. But, you know, it was on one of the stations I have, and I happened to tune into it. Thought, okay, it's an Oscar award winning film. This must be interesting. But I thought documentary. I thought I'm going to learn something about the present context, which you do. But it really felt more like a film to me. That's what surprised me. I mean, it just draws you in. I mean, this is really just, it has everything in there: drama, emotion, humor. And I've watched this several times, and I'm someone who never watches films multiple times, but I haven't gotten tired of watching this. It really, it makes you tear up at points. You're laughing. It's moving. And I think above all, it's because it's authentic. I mean, this is a documentary that features a school videographer, in a Russian school in the Urals, and it's his job to organize the events and to film what's happening within the school. And he's somebody who's grown up in this town, and he's been doing this forever, and everyone knows him. So there's this level of trust and familiarity. And he really captures, everyone in their natural state. To me, that's what I watched this, and I kind of felt like this is just the best acting I've ever seen, but it's not acting. People are just being themselves, and you can really see all the emotions right there in front of you. So I think that's why I personally enjoyed it. So I don't know, what was your reaction just as an experience? Did you enjoy watching it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching it as a story and as a documentary, and I think that Pasha Talankin's character really provides a through line. It's a story not just about his school where he works, but his own story as someone who grew up in this town, someone who decided to stay someone who loves students and loves his work, but he is caught essentially in this moment in history, and he is pained to see what happens to his school. So in a way, I think that for me, it was interesting how what this film shows is a kind of the insider-outsider look at what's happening in this Karabakh school, because he's both an insider as someone who's a teacher and has been there a long time, but he's also kind of, he says that he's never been like everybody else. So he's kind of an eccentric and has this unique perspective. But he also has, you know, a very strong moral compass. He understands, you know, that some things are just crazy, right? And I recall watching several interviews with him when he said, you know, this is not normal. Like, I wanted to show this to the rest of the world and to Russians to say, this is not normal. You should not take it. Yeah, I think that it is kind of an interesting look into the routinization of war propaganda and how people are just kind of taking it, and whether they're doing it, you know, with some grumbling or just acquiesce. That is, I think, the documentary value of that film, in addition to being a great story and obviously kind of a look into Russia that we don't see much on television.
And to me, I mean, what made it so appealing is just his love. He just loves this community. He's been a part of it, even though they kind of jokingly mix in humor at the very start that this is an industrial town. It's a polluted place. It's a place with a high rate of cancer, but it's his home. It's always been his home. And the contrast between what he's featuring, which is the militarization of the school system, and kind of an official form of patriotism, and his real sincere, authentic love of country, his love of place. It's the contrast between the two. And he stops it several times to explain what he means by his attachment and how his attachment to the country is, he thinks, is deeper and more profound than everything he sees going on in the school. To me, that's the sadness of it. He really loves the place in a deep way. He doesn't want to leave, but, and at one point he says love of country should mean that you should be able to criticize it. If you see something wrong, you should be able to speak up about it. And that kind of comes back again in the graduation speech, that you may have to make a decision. At one point, you may be at a crossroads. So it's really his love of country that forces his hand and leads to his decision to do this insider account of what's happening in the school system in Russia at present. But I think what interested me watching this is because we started our last conversation and you were explaining how much gratitude you had living at the time where you were finishing school, and it's the Gorbachev era and the Soviet Union is opening up. It becomes possible to talk about things that weren't possible to talk about before. The Stalinist past, the repressions, there's a lot of criticism going on. And this seems to be a Russia moving in exactly the opposite direction. So everything is shutting down, closing down, and there's less and less freedom. And I was curious watching this, what your reaction to that was. You know, what's at stake with what's happening now?
Yeah, I mean, watching this film, I didn't learn that much new about what's been happening in the country, in Russia, in the last, you know, 25 years. But the way that it presented it was really compelling. And Talonkin shows that things go pretty abruptly from kind of peacetime routine, however, you know, authoritarian it might have been, but there were pockets of freedom. His students were free to come to his office and hang out and maybe say certain things that were not supportive of the government. But there was kind of a sense that you could at least privately exchange views that were not official, right? And all of a sudden, things change overnight. And I think that that there's a moment when Talonkin shows how this printer is spewing a letter from above, a directive about this need for patriotic education and increased patriotism and learning from examples of heroes and so forth. So it's a kind of an abrupt transition we see in this film. When I was growing up, I mean, it's sort of, it's moving kind of in the opposite direction, although I would say that, you know, the Putin regime, even before 2022, had been slowly suffocating civil society and all sorts of freedoms. They were, you know, closing independent media. They were outlawing certain organizations. They were using extremist laws. They were labeling people and civil society organizations as foreign agents. So all of that had been going on, but I guess it became even more pernicious and really kind of overwhelming and ubiquitous after the beginning of the war. So no one could just go out into the street and even hold a piece of paper, like, because you would be immediately arrested. So that was kind of a rapid transition. And for me, it was the opposite, because we were in the late 80s, sort of waking up from the long totalitarian nightmare, even though things were not terrible. I mean, there was a war in Afghanistan that was going on. So there was a draft, and some of my schoolmates were sent to Afghanistan. So this was kind of the backdrop. But things were opening up. Gorbachev's policy of glasnost allowed independent media, independent investigations of the country's past and present. So there was a growing realization that, you know, it's okay. It's safe to express disagreement. It's safe to look at things that are not, not flattering to the regime. And of course, the Chernobyl disaster happened 40 years ago, actually, almost to the day, right? It was April 1986. So this was kind of the last straw of the regime. And it's really staggering to see the reverse happening in this film and the dying off any kind of dissent, any kind of possibility of dissent, and the need for internal immigration, right, that Talonkin voices in this film. He says that I became increasingly isolated from others. I could not talk to other people. So this is like the opposite of what I experienced as a young person in the Soviet Union, in the waning years of the Soviet Union.
I guess part of my question is because this is somebody who, and what's unusual about this school is that it's labeled a primary school. I don't know how typical this is, but it's a school. It seems to run from elementary grades all the way up through high school. So you've got somebody who has grown up in this town. He works in the school, but he's watching these people grow up from the time they're little kids to basically finishing school. And maybe some go on to university and some go into their adult lives after that. So he is basically looking at the horizons of the future, opening up. And so I guess when you made those comments earlier, I was thinking, well, the curiosity or the way in which you can now see the world, the kind of horizons that opened up to you, that became possible to you living at that time. And I thought the theme in this big theme is that it's going in the opposite direction, and that, and the comments made at several times, at several points, that for the young kids, they're being indoctrinated, and they're still at this impressionable age. They still haven't really formed their opinions about the world, and they're getting a lot of heavy stuff thrown at them. And for the older kids, they're still trying to figure out what they want to do, and they don't know yet, or they've got ideas that they're excited about. And there's this one girl, Masha, who wants to go into medical school, and there's this character, or other student, Vanya, who hasn't figured it out. We have some places he's interested in going to, but to me, the sadness of it seemed that those horizons are just getting closed off. And people are, there's a part of it's just trauma from the war too, that your relatives or your brothers, your friends, and maybe you are at risk of dying. And that to me seemed like the giant cloud that's hanging over the country that seems so different from your experience. So if you try to project into the future, what does it mean for the country? Is this like a lost generation possibly going into the future?
Yeah. And if you think about Talonkin's generation, so he's in his early 30s in this film, right? And so his generation is the generation that has been called by sociologists the unwhipped generation. So they are the ones who came of age during relative freedom in Russia, and they were the ones who protested in 2017 in protests against corruption that were organized by Alexei Navalny. And there was a lot of talk about how these young people are different from the Soviet generations. They are no longer Homo Sovieticus. They have a sense of their own mind. They do not accept authority just because it is authority. They tend to have better relationship with their parents. So it's a kind of a very contemporary, you know, let's say more like a Western mindset. Plus, they also have access to the internet. So they have much more freedom of access to all kinds of information, whereas their parents may have grown on television. And certainly television is still the medium of choice for a lot of older people who tend to support the government in Russia. So his generation is much more free-spirited and free-thinking, and he shows his library, right? And it is full of books that were published either in the late Soviet era or even like in the 90s. So his favorite author, I found out from one of the interviews he gave, his favorite author is Daniil Harms, who was a 20s and 30s writer and poet. And he published barely two poems during his lifetime, but he was kind of a famous avant-garde writer whose works were spread through samizdat in the 60s and 70s. And finally, they published four tomes of his collected works in the 90s. So for Pasha, this kind of absurdist writer is one of his favorites. And so you can see where his quirky sense of humor might be, you know, finding an outlet, right? So he's definitely nourished on much more than, you know, the government propaganda. And obviously books are an important source of freedom for anyone. And so it kind of shows you kind of this interesting contrast between private freedom in a way and public acquiescence to authority and propaganda. And so there, you know, Masha Gessen's book, The Future is History, is about how totalitarianism is returning to Russia. And I think the book ends in 2016. So it's even before all of the events, you know, before and after the war, at the beginning of the war. So it's documenting the stifling of civil society and protest. And it looks like now even kitchen conversations might get you in trouble. You cannot exchange private criticism of the government with your friends if you can be overheard by someone who can turn you in. So it's almost like a return to Stalin era fear, right, of authorities, and you're keeping your thoughts to yourself. And that's pretty horrible. Like, it's the opposite, the absolute opposite of freedom.
Okay. So if you look at Pasha Talonkin, who goes on and wins this Oscar, and it's almost like the Russia that could have been and the Russia that will be is the generation of kids in the classroom who have these kind of these reactions that you don't know what to make of, that kind of one of shock at what they're hearing, what they're experiencing, and they're being drilled and indoctrinated. And this is kind of the Russia to be, and it's kind of a frightening possibility for what this is going to mean for the future of the country and the rest of us. But if you look at teachers who are a big part of the story, I mean, they make the system work. And there's one clip at one point where they have Putin, who's the kind of omnipresent person in the school system. So it's giving you a window onto what's happening in the school. And you're also seeing how the media is functioning. And he's there. He's making these presentations being broadcast in the schools. The television is part of the backdrop throughout this whole documentary. And at one point he says the real people who win the wars are the teachers. The teachers are the real soldiers, most important in the fight. And the teachers that are featured, well, you have Pasha Telankin, who is resisting. He's resisting against the changes that he sees. There are other people like Pavel Abdumanov who are just embracing the everything that's happening. They're full in behind the regime. And then you've got most people who just seem to be going along, and there's just this feeling of, well, what can I do about it? I mean, they're grumbling. They've got an extra workload, but there's a suggestion at one point, well, there's so much extra work that's being put on the teachers with all the extra patriotic education that they literally don't have enough time to teach the students. And there's a meeting at one point where they're commenting, well, what do we do about this? But they're not really addressing the reason for it, that they have to spend so much time on the new patriotic agenda that they can't teach the kids how to learn, and they're falling behind. And so one person suggests, well, why don't we focus more on just learning and less on the patriotism? And it's like, we can't do that. We'll lose our jobs. So that's the reality. And I guess I was curious, you having gone through the Soviet system, I mean, does this recall the past? I mean, do you see these teachers that create this space of openness, so like Pavel Telankin, you see similar types of these archetypes, these types of teachers that you see who are full on in and promoting the state agenda, who are just towing the line, feeling powerless. To what extent did this recall your own past, your own experience in the system?
Yeah, this all looks very familiar, actually. And even though I would say that most of my teachers were probably born under Stalin, right? And it was that generation, and they may have experienced some freedom during the thaw era of Khrushchev. And my mom was a teacher. She taught literature for high school classes, and but like Telankin school, our school went from first through 10th grade, so it's an integrated educational establishment where you see everybody from the little ones to people who are ready to go to college, or practically adults. Yeah, we had a lot of teachers who were just kind of going along with the whole official discourse and propaganda, and I think that there was kind of a sense that we just have to go through the motions, that many of them perhaps did not believe it, but they didn't have any access to any alternative way of talking about things. And we had maybe one teacher who was an ideologue, and she also happened to be the school's principal, who would often chide us for not being perfect little communists. And, she often spoke in cliches. So it was pretty clear that, I don't know if she actually believed in all of that stuff, but the kind of the officialness of her speech pattern suggested that, she just basically accepted these dogmas without questioning them. Other teachers were just compliant, mostly. My mom, though, she was not a dissident, but I know that simply because I, was witnessing her at home, she really hated when they forced them to teach Brezhnev's trilogy in the late 70s, early 80s. So Brezhnev died in 1982. So in the late 70s, there appeared a trilogy that was supposed to extol his actions as a military leader, and then post-war reconstruction. He obviously didn't write it himself, and it was written by ghostwriters, and it was like a terrible piece of schlock from the literary perspective. And so my mom really kind of hated that she had to teach this atrocity. And she did not openly express her relief when he passed, but I'm sure she was happy not to teach it. And so it's, you know, Soviet people developed what they call a double think. So you could think whatever you want in private, but in public, you were supposed to go through the motions and say the words that were appropriate. Otherwise, you would get in trouble.
Yeah, on the one hand, you feel like, yeah, okay, you're going to lose your job if you speak up, if you step out of line. But on the other hand, is like they cut Pavel or Pasha a lot of slack. I mean, he is doing things. He's taking a lot of chances in the course of the documentary. He's doing things that at one point he plays the U.S. national anthem. It seems at every point where he's pushed too far, he really feels like he's just promoting the propaganda of the regime, or things are happening, or his students are at risk of dying, and he gets so fed up that he has to do something, and he acts out, and he does this at several times, playing the national anthem over the school sound system, and lowering the flag on the roof, or changing the Z's, the taped Z on the window to the X, to try to show this show of support for Ukraine. So at several points, he does things and he's reprimanded. And they show that it's a small community. People kind of know what your position is. And at the end, it seems like maybe he's in a more precarious position. But at the same time, he's kind of getting slapped on the wrist. He never loses his job. He does some pretty daring things. So you kind of wonder how much space do teachers really have. To what extent, to me at least, that was one of the thoughts that crossed my mind. To what extent are they just making it all possible? Maybe there's more space for them to do more. And even the students, I thought, was fascinating. At one point, they're showing how they're told that they have to write letters to the soldiers. And
yeah, Masha writes a letter and talks about her own worries about her own brother who is serving at the front. Yeah, it turns out to be a sad letter. So she uses this as a way to work through her emotions. And it's a kind of quiet subversiveness, I guess. Small acts of insubordination that may or may not get you in trouble. And it seems to me that this school is a very kind of tight community, and everybody knows Pasha. His mom works at the library there, and as far as I know, she still is employed by that school. So he's kind of seen as a kind of an eccentric, maybe, and does not pose any threat, real threat.
I guess what's coming to mind is I had an episode recently, and it was on Holocaust distortion in Poland. And you think, okay, if you shelter Jews in Poland during the German occupation, you risked your life. And that's why people were reluctant to do it. And the professor I interviewed said that wasn't the case at all. It's like it wasn't as much of a risk as you would think. And that a lot of people just went along, or they saw an opportunity. And I don't know. I watched this and I kind of wondered, could people be doing more? And could there be more civil disobedience? And to what extent? Do you blame the regime, or do you blame the people who are part of the machinery for making it work? I don't know, just curious to get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe different in a smaller community like Karabash, where maybe it's not even considered to be a hotbed of dissent by the authorities, right? Although apparently in the aftermath of the film coming out, FSB went to Karabash and talked to everyone, all of the teachers, and basically told them, this person does not exist. This film does not exist. You're not going to say anything, no commentary whatsoever. So it's, you know, they were all silenced, but who knows, like, should the regime fall? Like, would they embrace Talamkin with open arms? So I think that it's kind of, yeah, I mean, they all understand what's mm-hmm. going on. And, but yeah, fear is a real thing. Fear is a real thing. And, you know, as I mentioned in my book about sort of the marginalization of memory of Soviet political terror in a lot of places, like in Siberia and smaller towns, people asked Memorial, the human rights organization that collected the names and published them, the names of Soviet-era political victims, they asked them to remove the names of their relatives from the list because they were fearing persecution. So, yeah, and it's become even more so, right? So Stalin is now being resurrected as a model national leader, as a sort of predecessor of Putin. So it has gotten very, very difficult to dissent openly. And I agree that there are probably small acts of insubordination or acts that kind of go against the inhumane, cannibalistic ideology of this regime, as when people preserve older buildings or go into some remote areas and restore old churches that are falling apart. So all of this shows their patriotism without being explicitly oppositional.
I guess as I was watching this, I'm seeing it through the lens of your book, having read your book, and your book looks at the cult of the Great Patriotic War, and clearly the state is doing a lot of work to promote that memory for its own interests. And your point is that, yeah, that's true. There's this top-down process, but there's a bottom-up process going on as well. And this resonates with families in powerful ways, that Putin is tapping into a powerful source of family memory. And I mean, the emphasis here in this documentary is the state. The state is sending these directives. The teachers have to follow these directives. There's the anthem that you've got to listen to and march to every morning. The teachers have these scripted lessons. Eventually, students have scripted lessons, and everybody is following the official line. And I was curious watching this. Do you feel like that part is left out? To what extent is the state broadcasting on a wavelength that people are already attuned to or more receptive to receive? Is that left out of it? Is there a culture that it's able to tap into? Whereas this seems to be just cast as a kind of one-way process. And you have these classroom scenes where the teachers are preaching and then he'll look around. I thought those were among the most powerful points in the documentary, where you just see these looks of shock, and then the students don't know what to make of what's happening, what they're being told by their teachers. But your point is that there's a culture that people have been immersed in that really promotes the memory of the glories of the Great Patriotic War and militarism. And to what extent does a lot of this messaging, you think, resonate with people? Is that left out of this?
I think the film emphasizes the top-down propaganda and kind of the forced nature of it. Although there is one scene that shows the celebration of V-Day, May 9th, which is the day of victory of the Soviet Union over Nazi Germany, that is still celebrated everywhere in Russia. And one of the key elements of it that has been the key element of it since the early teens, since like 2012, is the procession of the Immortal Regiment. And you see this happening in Karabakh as well, where people, school children, are carrying portraits of their ancestors. So the movement started as a kind of counterpoint to the official celebration of victory, as a kind of more private, family-driven commemoration, but it was hijacked by United Russia to serve its kind of more propagandistic PR ends. And of course, you know, in 2015, Putin marched with his own father's portrait in the parade in Moscow. So there's a kind of emerging of the bottom up and the top down. But I think Talonkin's film does not really lean into the family memory of World War II as much beyond that one brief moment when he's showing students carrying the portraits. I think that there's a kind of a more of a nostalgic patriotism for all things Soviet in a way that we see even in the selection of songs, right? Because he's starting the film before the war, right? He's starting it with a clip of young children singing the song, May There Always Be Sunshine. And it's, you know, a Soviet era song that we all sang. So it goes something like that. May there always be sunshine. May there always be blue sky. May there always be mama. May there always be me. And so he freezes it. He freezes the shot, the frame, and introduces himself. And then the ending song at the graduation party is Широка страна моя родная. Wide is my beloved country, right? So it was also, you know, a Stalin era song that is embraced. So I think that there is a kind of a more of a musical, almost a sonic memory that is much more permanent and has been, you know, instead of being like a top-down inculcated script, it is almost like a bodily memory. So, and this is kind of what I talk about in the book, that a lot of the memories of the Great Patriotic War are built from bottom up, right? And even though the exposure, the maybe the artifacts, the media that propagated them were official, but people have come to love certain films and songs and they became part of the kind of a repertoire, right? Like we cannot relate to our sense of patriotism without these songs, for example, right? And so I think that there's much more about this kind of more subtle indoctrination that maybe Talonkin doesn't really point out, but it's still there. I don't even know if he understands that these songs appeal to him because he has been exposed to them since he was a little kid.
That's kind of the ambient memory culture.
Ambient memory, absolutely.
But it was interesting on the May 9th celebration that, I mean, it's this national commemoration of the victory in the Great Patriotic War, but it's localized too. I mean, they go to this local monument and they're remembering the workers from that community who sacrificed during the war. So mm-hmm. It is being brought, the memory is being anchored in that community. And I mean, for Pasha, I mean, for him, he's like, he makes this powerful comment, like, well, what are we learning here? That one day you too can be a dead mm-hmm. soldier. That was pretty powerful as people are holding up those portraits. But, and the priest is in on the act too. Mm-hmm. The priest is encouraging them to recall the memory of sacrifices during World War II and to live up to that past.
Yeah. And I think there's visually a brilliant shot that shows kind of the big picture of that celebration that has the copper plant in the background, along with the church that was built, you know, post-Soviet, right? And then the monument. So you have the industry that provides sustenance, but also poisons your air and water. And then you have the institutions of indoctrination one way or another, right? So it's a very kind of poignant scene, I think, in this film that communicates volumes. Yeah, and the priest, of course, is voicing the line, the party line in a way, which has been the function of the Russian Orthodox Church and, you know, in the person of its patriarch, right, who blessed the troops, which is not uncommon like across the world, but he basically spoke about the glory of dying for the motherland, of how your sins will be washed away. And this especially related to Prigozhin's, the Wagner group that was drawing its men from jails, right? From basically gulags. Yeah. So it's a very poignant thing. And I think Talamkin does acknowledge or admit woefully that they have taught our youth too well to love their country. And so this is kind of his commentary when he realizes that these young men that he saw growing up and go through his classroom are signing up for the war, or they're being drafted and they don't do anything about it. So there's almost like the sense of inevitability that comes with it, right? So it's just like what you do. So in this way, what the history teacher Abdulmanov says, that you love your country not because it does something for you, but because it's your mother. So there's a kind of a familial metaphor at work, right? That, you know, you could have a dysfunctional family with a mother that doesn't love you very much, but you still have to love her and act on it. So it's a very sad state of affairs.
And then he goes on to say, if you don't, you're basically a parasite. You should leave. You should leave the country. And then the camera pans the student faces, right? And it's kind of not knowing what to make of it. But I guess we spent a lot of time in our last conversation talking about this ambient Stalinism and how you look at places like Moscow and you have towers that are being built that recall that the Stalin era, or subways that are being renovated, exhibitions that are being put on, and how the surroundings can tap into that past. And I guess you're watching this film where right up front they're saying, hey, this is one of the most polluted places in the Urals, and a lot of people are dying of cancer. At the same time, the main character has this deep attachment to his home, right? And he's trying to show you the emotional, personal side of that. But I guess I was wondering, how does the nostalgia work in a place like this? It's hard to try to project the glories of the state when you have this kind of decaying industrial backdrop. I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, there are at least two kinds of nostalgia that Svetlana Boym talks about in her book, The Future of Nostalgia. One is restorative, which refers to sort of more official efforts to bring back the past in all its bombastic glory. So rebuilding giant cathedrals in Moscow, or renovating skyscrapers, subways, kind of restoring the look, the glossy look of the era, of Stalin era, that, and of course, resurrecting certain rituals of that era, right? So it's kind of like the bombastic patriotism, the performative patriotism, right? So that nostalgia, you don't see much of that except in sort of more ritual processions on V-Day and the celebration of V-Day. But Talamkin's nostalgia is what Boym would call reflective nostalgia. It's something that dwells on details, kind of loving details, and emphasizes the longing rather than the grandeur or, you know, something that you have. So I think Talamkin's nostalgia, the whole film in a way depicts this place as it's kind of a love letter in a way to Karabakh, right? Even though he's portraying things that are extremely painful to him, and they're tearing him away from this town, his motherland. So this is his little piece of motherland, his own private Karabakh. And in interviews, he said that, you know, he has traveled now outside of the country and has been to a lot of other places in Europe, and he would see all of these nice mansions and beautiful towns. But even though they're all kind of different architecturally, they all seem to be the same. While if he looks at these, you know, gray cement block apartment buildings in Karabakh, they all look very depressing, kind of from afar. But as you get closer, each balcony would have like a different vignette, or like flowers, or different. You know, furniture or color. So people find ways of beautifying that gray reality on a very small scale. And so this is, he finds it very endearing. And of course, he talks about the weather and how he loves the frost when you have to like run for shelter. All of that is definitely a part of nostalgia and patriotism that, you know, will bring him back if he's allowed to. Now, Talonkin doesn't want to stay abroad. He wants to come back to Karabakh.
Okay. So this whole documentary is really an act of resistance. I mean, he is fed up with being the school videographer and being a pawn in the system, and he's ready to quit his job until he sees this announcement. He's scrolling through social media and he sees this announcement. How has the war affected you? And it's really an act of courage that he responds in an open way that it's affected my job in every way. And he's sticking his neck way out there to do this. And he does this on a number of occasions. And he gets this response eventually that from this person, David Borenstein, the director, that this invitation to collaborate on this documentary about what's happening inside the school system. And he decides to go back and take back his letter of resignation. And he realizes he can now become a director inside the school system. He can film everything that's happening and make this into a film. And so it becomes an act of resistance, this whole documentary. And it raises questions about what spaces for resistance exist. And you finish your own book that way, and you're looking at digital media, and we talked a little bit about Memorial International. Are those spaces being just erased? What can you still do inside the country? Eventually, Pashi, he has to leave. He realizes he can't, as much as he feels like his country should be a place where you can express your love of it through criticism of things that are wrong, he realizes it's never going to be possible. He's got to leave for this film to be released, and he knows it'll never be shown in his own community. People will never see it. And as you mentioned, the authorities go into that town and make the point that don't communicate with this guy, although I've heard that they're not really able to enforce that. But what's your sense of are there still spaces he's able to sneak this information out of the country, and he's there for several years where he's able to collaborate with a director outside of Russia, and they basically put much of this together, and he has to leave to finish the process. But are there still spaces for resistance there, or are they just becoming fewer and fewer?
That's a very good question. And I think it's kind of an ongoing struggle because a lot of Russians for a very long time have been using VPNs to access sites that were blocked by the Russian government. And but they're cracking down on VPNs. So it's a kind of like a game of catching up, right? And most recently, they shut down the internet for 2 weeks in major cities. So it's a major war against the digital realm or ability of people to be more free within that realm. And Talonkin, interestingly enough, did not upload his videos, the footage, to any clouds. And he was asked this question by a lot of interviews, like, why did you have to carry out your hard disks, right, in your luggage? And he's like, well, because of sanctions, we're not able to use the cloud. There are so many things that Russians within Russia cannot use, even though services like the Telegram and WhatsApp have been widely used. And of course, they use not just for, subversive activity, but like for everyday use. So everybody's using them in some way. So I don't know what percentage of that stuff could be considered dissent. I wouldn't know. But apparently authorities think that it is very dangerous. So they are afraid of people doing stuff. So it means that they realize that they can never fully close that iron curtain on people. no matter how much they put, you know, how much effort they put into it.
That's interesting because, you know, when I used to lecture on the end of the Soviet Union, one of the themes was that it gets to this impasse where it has this first industrial revolution, becomes a superpower, but it needs to move on to the next stage of the information revolution. But it has to control information to survive. And it's only the KGB that really has access to all the information. And once you start to have this technology like fax machines and people can start printing things, it really becomes harder and harder for the state to retain a monopoly of information. And if it does, it can't grow economically. It reaches an impasse. So here you wonder, I don't know, maybe Putin's regime has resolved that problem somehow. They've harnessed that technology without stagnating the state or the system, or maybe that's happening. Everything you read and you hear about Russia now, there's so much of the resources of the country are being funneled into the military that what that's going to mean for the future of the country is a huge question mark. But I don't know. It seemed like this is a – is it winning the information game? Would you take that away from seeing what's happening? Did it somehow solve that dilemma that the Soviet Union couldn't resolve? I mean, that was part of the idea of glasnost and perestroika, right? In order to rejuvenate the system, it has to open up. Well, here he's trying to figure out a way. Well, how can you make it more like a Singapore, more of an authoritarian state where you can somehow have enough creativity or enough, you know?
Yeah. I mean, over the years, over the last maybe a decade and a half, the Russian government has been trying to implement what China already has or has had longer. And these are different ways of surveying citizens' internet activity, right, and social media activity. So they would pass all kinds of laws and also demand that carriers share their customer bases, so the information on users is available to the security services. So there is a kind of culture of surveillance that has existed for a while now, and yet, you know, VPNs have been able to circumvent this on a large scale, I would say. And right now, it seems like they're not playing the game. They're trying to shut down the game altogether. And there has been an uproar, grumbling from the business community, because even in Moscow itself, they've lost, you know, billions in just 2 weeks from the shutting down of the internet and mobile internet, because people could no longer carry out their commercial activities the way they used to, right? So yeah, it definitely runs into this problem of efficiency and sustainability. If you're trying to destroy all little places where people might be doing subversive stuff, you're gonna take out the whole system, right? The whole grid. And this is kind of what they've been trying to do. And maybe that's a sign of crisis and desperation, personally thinking. I don't know. I cannot predict any of these things. I'm not an IT specialist, but from what I've heard from other commentators, that definitely is a sign of weakness, not strength.
So this, for much of our conversation, you might think, this is just a very heavy, serious documentary, which it is in a lot of respects. I mean, it's the war encroaching on the school, the town, the students who you don't know what's going to happen to them in the future. Some are dying. But at the same time, there's a lot of humor in this throughout the whole documentary. And I'm wondering, to what extent is this just fundamentally kind of a feature of Russian culture, and how people deal with really difficult conditions you've got to kind of laugh. You've got to have this sense of humor. You got to find ways to lighten the mood, to be able to cope with everything happening around you.
Absolutely. I think it's almost like a genetic trait, dark humor, a sarcasm that allows you to carve just, you know, a small psychological space of freedom, right? Because laughter, at least temporarily, destroys fear. Temporarily, right? But it is nonetheless a space of freedom, however small. And, Talonkin's love for Daniil Harms is a very important reminder, where he sees himself as a kind of prankster or trickster character. He cracks jokes and even, you know, telling the story of his traveling through security with his hard disks in Yekaterinburg. He was like, oh, yeah, I was kind of worried. I was really scared. And then they said, yeah, you're free to go. And so he said, I crossed the line, you know, I'm out free practically. And I was, something in me was saying, don't you want to go back and say, are you forgetting to ask me something? So it's almost like living dangerously, right? So I think that it shows, and it kind of punctuates this humor, sarcastic humor punctuates the story of the film, and keeps Talonkin going despite his despair.
Yeah. And last point is what I really appreciate after having read your book, because your big theme throughout was the spirit of sacrifice, that if you're remembering the Great Patriotic War, it's all about the memory of sacrificing for the motherland. And this is something that Putin is able to tap into in conjunction with families. And you really see this throughout, but Talonkin himself is an example of how the spirit of sacrifice works in opposition to the regime as well, and that there is a daringness to it, that people really take some risks and risk everything to fight against things that are important, important for them. And so that, that theme of sacrifice was evident throughout, not just in encouraging people to support the war, but in trying to understand why people would, like a Talonkin, would risk everything and the home that he loves so much to do what he does.
Yeah, Talonkin's character certainly models a different way of being a good citizen, right? A patriot. You love your work, you love the people you work with, you love your city and do everything to make it better. These are all traits of a patriot. And it is very sad that the only way to show your patriotism under the current regime is to die for it on the front line, right? So he's definitely embodying a different way of thinking about what a good citizen should be like or could be like. And I certainly think that we need more Talonkins out there.
Katya, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Rick.
I've been talking with Katya Haskins about the 2026 Oscar award-winning documentary, Mr. Nobody Against Putin. Katya is a professor of rhetoric and visual studies at Pennsylvania State University and the author of Remembering the War, Forgetting the Terror, Appeals to Family Memory in Putin's Russia, now available in paperback. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member, subscribe on our YouTube channel or your favorite podcast app, and review us wherever you can. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.